invalidating preclearance, the Supreme Court has shifted the burden back onto citizens facing discrimination.
Looking for changes to the Voting Rights Act after the recent Supreme Court decision. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, August 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, as Coast Guard vessels get larger, Petersburg residents voice concern over losing the cutter Anacapa.
They're going to be retiring the 110-foot vessels and bringing larger vessels to southeast.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable contributions. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
In June, the United States Supreme Court struck down a key formula of the Voting Rights Act. Section 4 of the 1965 law determined which states needed to get federal approval before changing any voting laws. Alaska was one of nine states subject to that rule known as preclearance. Immediately following the early summer ruling, a frustrated Attorney General Eric Holder condemned the decision.
Existing statutes cannot totally fill the void left by today's Supreme Court ruling. And I am hopeful that new protections can and will pass in this session of Congress.
As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, congressional action is highly unlikely anytime soon.
Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts wrote in his opinion that voter discrimination still exists. The court did not invalidate the entire act, just the formula determining which states need federal scrutiny. Those states included Alaska, and there have always been those in the state who have thought that was unfair, including Governor Sean Parnell, who ordered the state to join the lawsuit against it. The court ruled that Congress could update the formula it uses to determine which states those are. The guidelines had not been updated for decades.
Right now, there's no appetite.
Congressman Don Young says there's no real enthusiasm in Congress to tackle the issue now. And he adds the Department of Justice can still enforce the Voting Rights Act if there's proven discrimination. It just can't require permission in the nine states previously covered under Section 5. Alaska does work to ensure Native participation in the electoral process. It provides interpreters to regions in the state with high populations of people who don't speak English well enough to understand the ballot. Young says in some of those cases, the interpretation services are insufficient.
Some cases for the elderly, probably not. It's hard to find any Alaska Native that doesn't speak English.
Congress is on recess until the second week of September. It returns to just nine legislative days before the end of the fiscal year. So the floor calendar, however slim, will be filled with debates on funding the government and raising the nation's borrowing limit. Both the House and Senate Judiciary Committees have held preliminary hearings since the court struck down Section 4. And to some, like Senator Lisa Murkowski, that may be all that happens.
Because I'm not sensing that there is this drive. You know, right after the Supreme Court ruled on this, a lot of discussion, a lot of talk going around. But you didn't hear kind of this unanimous cry that we've got to go out now and address legislatively.
Murkowski credits the Alaska Native vote for her general election success in 2010. The state has a history of discrimination against Alaska Natives. At one point, it required literacy tests to vote. In 2010, a federal court determined the state's interpretation services in Bethel were insufficient. James Tucker of Counsel with Wilson Elser argued that case. He recently filed suit in the same court, alleging the state has not implemented the changes required statewide. He says even though the Supreme Court struck down federal preclearance for the entire state, some protections remain intact, like Section 203. That's the provision that provides for language assistance.
What remains is that the state of Alaska continues to be covered in a total of nine different areas of the state. Seven of those are for Alaska Native languages, and there are two additional regions in the Aleutian Island chain that are also covered for Filipino and for Spanish.
Senator Mark Begich is the only one in the delegation who says Alaska still needs to be subject to federal oversight. He says the state should spend more resources assuring everyone who wants to vote can. He dismisses attempts from some Republicans that would require IDs at the polls.
They spend a lot of energy claiming we have fraud, which of course we don't. But they spend a lot of energy on that. And again, I think that's to deny capacity for people to access voting in certain parts of Alaska.
Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell, who oversees the Division of Elections, ignored calls for comment. He's also running for the nomination to replace Begich in 2014. The issue is searing with politics. Speaking Monday in San Francisco, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton vowed to make voting rights her major focus for the foreseeable future. That from the person many people assume to be the frontrunner in the next presidential election. Clinton told the American Bar Association broad bipartisan coalitions of Congress reauthorized the act in 2006.
In the past 15 years, under both Democratic and Republican presidents, the Department of Justice has used the law to block nearly 90 discriminatory changes to state and local election rules. And many more were withdrawn under scrutiny.
She ticked off a list of recent election changes since the court invalidated Section 4. On Monday, the governor of North Carolina signed into law a bill reducing early voting and ending same-day registration.
These are all changes that would have required federal approval under the Voting Rights Act, but now can go forward without scrutiny. By invalidating preclearance, the Supreme Court has shifted the burden back onto citizens facing discrimination.
The issue may not get any legislative action, but it will certainly get its fair time in the run-up to the next election. For his part, Senator Begich predicts Congress will do something. He won't say whether it will happen before the 2014 race, a race where he'll need every Alaska Native vote he can get. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Petersburg officials are seeking answers about the future of Coast Guard ships in the community. Borough Mayor Mark Jensen sent a letter to Senator Mark Begich voicing concern that the cutter Anacapa could be replaced by larger vessels planned for other southeast ports. KFSK's Joe Vicknicki reports.
The letter makes the case that the 110-foot Anacapa should remain in service or a replacement vessel should remain in Petersburg because of the community's centralized location, along with the high vessel traffic and fishing fleets that call here. Jensen raised that issue at an assembly meeting this month.
They're going to be retiring the 110-foot vessels and bringing larger vessels to southeast, and it's important to the community to try to keep the Coast Guard presence in Petersburg.
The Anacapa was built in 1990 in Lockport, Louisiana. The ship underwent a major overhaul in 2009. It performs search and rescue, homeland security, and law enforcement. The Coast Guard plans to purchase new 154-foot Sentinel-class fast response cutters, as they're called. They'll replace the older 110-foot Island-class cutters across the nation. Two Sentinel-class boats are planned for Ketchikan as early as 2015 and one in Juneau around 2020. The service plans to build a new pier in Ketchikan to accommodate the larger vessels there. Borough Manager Steve Giesbrecht alerted the Assembly to that issue earlier this summer, noting that the Petersburg's current Coast Guard dock would not be able to handle the larger boat.
You know, the Anacapa is not going anywhere right now, but at some point it will be retired. And if the trend continues, then you could see that they wouldn't be replacing, you know, they wouldn't be bringing the big cutters here.
Coast Guard officials contacted for this story could not say what the plan is for Petersburg in the long term. However, Chief Petty Officer Kip Wadlow, a spokesperson for the Coast Guard's District 17 in Alaska, says the Island-class cutters will need replacements.
What we're seeing is that, while they are quite capable, the future missions of the Coast Guard, you know, need us to have a more capable platform.
That more capable platform means longer ships that can operate in heavier seas and travel faster with a larger crew and with newer technology.
The fast response cutters are going to be more efficient. They have updated technology and systems on board that will make them better assets for conducting the Coast Guard's current missions and the Coast Guard's missions going into the future.
The Island-class ships are manned by a crew of 16, while the fast response cutters will have a crew of 24. The Anacapa is one of seven island-class 110-footers in Alaska. Two are stationed in Ketchikan, and others are homeported in Juneau, Valdez, Seward, and Homer. Senator Lisa Murkowski says the problem speaks to a bigger issue, a declining budget for a Coast Guard that's been asked to expand its role.
We have tasked our Coast Guard to do more and more and more, expand their missions up north, take on fisheries enforcements and enhanced roles in our northern waters, and yet we're not giving them any more assets, that we're not giving them any more staffing or manpower. We are stretching them to their limits.
Murkowski says the concerns in Petersburg are reflected elsewhere in the state. She says she'll be traveling with the Commandant of the Coast Guard when he visits Alaska later this month and would bring him the message of the importance of vessels stationed in coastal communities. With help from Robbie Feinberg in Petersburg, I'm Joe Wicknicki.
FBI records show that serial killer Israel Keyes told authorities five people in Washington state were among his 11 victims. Keyes was caught after killing his last victim, Anchorage resident Samantha Koenig. More details about the killings emerged when the FBI released more than 6 hours of interviews conducted before Keyes committed suicide in an Anchorage jail last December. Keyes indicated one person was killed and buried near Nia Bay. A couple were murdered and buried, and two other people in separate incidents were killed and submerged in one or two lakes. He gave authorities few other details. The FBI has released the interviews and a timeline with the hopes that someone might be able to match his movements in the past 12 years to missing people. Links are at our website, alaskapublic.org. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the interior fire season that just won't end.
There is a temporary flight restriction around that fire area, and that it is not safe or legal for private pilots to fly into that area.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Executives at Alaska Airlines and Peninsula Airways admit their service to Unalaska isn't perfect. Lopsided demand for flights and rough Aleutian weather already make it tough for them to serve the community. But huge demand from Arctic Oil employees might make it even tougher. As KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports in a follow-up to yesterday's story, Unalaska faces an uphill battle to get better air service before growth picks up in the Arctic.
No one was happier to see Shell in Unalaska last summer than Mayor Shirley Marquardt.
Said, well, you can fill up anything you want. Your business is great.
And they did, booking plenty of hotel rooms and car rentals. But there was one service that Shell didn't snap up, Penn Air's passenger flights. Instead, Shell mostly opted to charter planes.
They said, look, we've got to bring people in too, but we don't want to shut down what's going on in Unalaska, so we're going to charter as much as possible.
While that might have worked for Shell this past year, there are only so many charters in the market.
And if ConocoPhillips and Statoil in the next year or two are right on their heels, it's going to get real interesting.
That's why Marquardt wants to see some strategic planning from Alaska Airlines and Penn Air so they can meet that demand and the needs of the community. Penn Air is working on planning for the future, according to their CEO, Danny Siebert. Those plans just don't have a lot to do with Unalaska. The airline recently standardized its fleet, moving entirely to Saab 340 planes, a plane that Siebert says was only designed to go about 300 miles start to finish.
Now, anytime you exceed that 300 miles, then you're trading performance and payload for fuel.
A 300-mile range is perfect for flying on the East Coast, where Penn Air secured almost $15 million in federal essential air service contracts last year. But it's not great for flying to Unalaska, which is 800 miles from Anchorage. Siebert says they're not giving up the Unalaska route, but he also doesn't have plans to find an aircraft that's better suited to it. As far as he's concerned, there is no better plane.
All we can do is say we have looked at them, we do look at them, and right now we still just evaluate everything.
Penn Air's partner, Alaska Airlines, has also been doing some evaluations. They've decided to start flying smaller planes to some communities in Alaska rather than using jets year-round. The Bombardier Q400 seats just 76 people, many fewer than a jet, but still three times as many as fit on one of Penn Air's Saabs. Sales Director Scott Haberstadt says Alaska Airlines did look at putting the Q400 in on Alaska.
The aircraft just didn't work with the size of the runway out there. The runway is just not long enough to operate in and out of there with it.
That's true, sort of. On Alaska's runway, even after a recent $28 million upgrade, isn't designed to accommodate the Q400. But it could, with special permission from the Federal Aviation Administration. The FAA says they might restrict weights or require special training. Usually, it would be up to the airline to initiate that, but the FAA says they reached out to Alaska Airlines to see if they would want to create a plan for using the Q400 in on Alaska. The airline declined. They can still change their minds, but the FAA says their standards are going to stay the same, and they acknowledge that the special rules they make can be expensive. So Penn Air isn't buying more planes anytime soon, and Alaska Airlines doesn't want to use the ones it has. Where does that leave on Alaska? Penn Air CEO Danny Siebert says he's had to adjust his expectations for the route. He's got a different set of standards for flying to the Aleutians as opposed to anywhere else.
I consider if we schedule 3 airplanes into Alaska and 3 airplanes make it in the same day, that was a successful day.
After about 30 years in the community, Mayor Shirley Marquardt says she understands that it's hard to fly here, but she hasn't given up on getting better service, and she's going to lobby the airlines for it.
It's probably time for another sit-down face-to-face with Alaska Airlines, and what I would want to know is, what's your plan? What do you see happening in this market, and how do you plan on making it work for all of your customers and for the community?
That might improve things down the road, but for now, passengers will keep getting caught up in all of this, and when they get stuck, they'll try anything to get out. Lowell Wuhr is a seafood processor who was on the way to his daughter's high school graduation when his flight was delayed this spring. He wanted to leave as much as anyone, but he wasn't pestering the gate agents or calling the airlines for help. Wuhr put his faith somewhere else.
I say, I pray to God to lift me out.
You pray to God to lift you out, Dutch Harbor?
That's what I say.
Eventually, his prayer was answered. I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
A Fort Wainwright-based helicopter unit will be conducting night fly exercises later this month. The Army Aviation Task Force training is scheduled to run 2 weeks, beginning August 18th. U.S. Army Alaska North Deputy Chief of Public Affairs Captain Patrick Sawicki says deployments, training, and support missions have prevented this training from happening locally in the recent years. He says the 10 p.m. to 3 a.m. helicopter operations will be conducted on Fort Wainwright, as well as in the Yukon training area southeast of Fairbanks and the Donnelly training area near Delta Junction.
There's currently no live fire exercises scheduled. It is just the pilots flying with goggles during low visibility and night hours.
Sawicki says pilots will try to avoid urban areas and will use established air routes to get to training areas to minimize noise. He says the night training is part of an annual qualification process for the Aviation Task Force pilots who fly a variety of aircraft.
They'll be flying the CH-47 Chinooks, the UH-60 Blackhawks, and the Kiowas. And each pilot, regardless of airframe and helicopter type, has to meet these criteria and these qualifications for goggles flying.
Sawicki asks that anyone with questions or concerns to contact Fort Wainwright. He says future helicopter exercises will include live fire training, and there will be an announcement prior to that happening. The Mississippi fire continues to grow in the interior. Managers of the wildfire west of Delta Junction report an 11,000 gain yesterday, swelling the burn area to more than 52,000 acres total. The fire is about a mile and a half from the Tanana River, and Information Officer Pete Buist says firefighters primarily focus on protecting private property in neighborhoods and on homesteads south of the river.
Along the Richardson Clearwater at Whitestone Farms, and at a development called South Bank. Also doing some patrol work and assessment work and a little bit of plumbing with hose and sprinklers and that sort of thing on the north side of the Tanana, because if we got another real stiff wind out of the south, that fire has the potential to spot across the Tanana.
223 people are assigned to the Mississippi fire. The Caribou Creek fire, which started Sunday east of Fairbanks near the Salcha River, slowed somewhat yesterday after initially showing rapid growth. Information Officer Jim Schwarber says crews are working to protect cabins and mining sites and cautioned the public not to fly into the area.
There is a
temporary flight restriction around that fire area, and that it is not safe or legal for private pilots to fly into that area. There's been a lot of interest for folks to go in, and we wanted to emphasize that we do have plenty of firefighters that are up there specifically to protect those cabins, and there's no need for folks to go up there.
56 firefighters are working the Caribou Creek fire, and Schwarber says an additional crew is being brought up from Tok to help out. The fire is listed at 1,100 acres.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at thealaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
After more than 2 days of trolling for salmon during the Golden North Salmon Derby in Juneau, Jody Haas and her family were wrapping it up when one decided to bite. KTOO's Lisa Fu has the story of the big fish that didn't get away.
Jody Haas describes the majority of Derby weekend as pretty dull. Haas and husband Jason, 6-year-old son Carvin, and 4-year-old daughter Landia launched their 22-foot Olympic from Douglas Friday night to spend the whole weekend fishing. By about noon on Sunday, they decided to call it quits after lunch. Haas retreated into the boat to make hot turkey sandwiches.
I heard the initial zing of line being taken, so I ran out onto the deck.
It took Haas about 15 minutes to reel in the winning king salmon.
It was fighting with all its might, swimming all around the boat prop and underneath the boat, and a couple times we thought we were going to lose it. It was going to get tangled in something.
Once it got close to the boat, Jason Haas netted the king.
My husband said, okay, when it gets up to the boat, don't freak out. And I said, why? How big is it? He goes, just don't freak out. I didn't actually see it until it got in the boat. And then, yeah, I was freaking out.
Meanwhile, as Haas was catching a big fish, no one was checking on lunch.
The meat ended up being burnt to a crisp.
Using a boat scale, the fish weighed in at 28 pounds.
We decided we better get into town fast, so he got the gear in the boat, and I went inside and threw the lunch out the windows and started motoring into town.
At the official Derby weigh-in station at Douglas Harbor, her fish actually weighed 29.2 pounds, which put her in first place. Haas was shocked.
We went home, and we were sitting around biting our nails until 6 o'clock, just worrying if anybody was going to pass it or not.
Haas's first-place prize includes $10,000 in cash. Her plan is to use it as down payment for property in Gustavus, where a cabin will one day be built. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska has failed to meet the Yukon River Chinook escapement goal into Canada, despite increased fishing restrictions this summer. An Alaska Department of Fish and Game sonar counter at Eagle counted 28,369 kings as of August 8th. With the run tailing off to just a few hundred fish a day, State Yukon Area Summer Season Manager Eric Newland says escapement into Canada will fall well short of this year's minimum goal.
Preliminary projection at the sonar for Chinook Salmon Passage is approximately 30 to 32,000 at Eagle, and this would fall well below the escapement goal of 42,500 to 55,000 escapement goal established by the U.S.-Canada Yukon River Panel.
The Canadian escapement goal has been missed 4 out of the last 10 years, including last year. Newland says increased fishing closures and gear restrictions reduced the Alaska side Yukon king harvest 40% in 2012. Only 114,000 kings have been tallied entering the Yukon River's mouth at Pilot Station. Newland says managers take the Canadian escapement goal seriously.
We're looking at a production level of somewhere around one return per spawner. So it's pretty important that we make these goals if we want to see fish in the future.
Newland says the king run is difficult to manage because it's overlapped by a much stronger summer chum salmon return. An abundance of king salmon is not a phrase heard very often in Alaska this season, but abundance is exactly what the small southeast community of Skagway has this summer at the mouth of a little pond and creek in the middle of town. Margaret Friedenauer of KHNS has more.
With all the declining king salmon runs around the state, some at historic lows, other prompting emergency declarations, Skagway this year actually has more king salmon returning to Pullen Pond and Creek than fishermen and biologists know what to do with. Brian Elliott is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game Assistant Area Manager for Sport Fish for Skagway and Haines.
We are seeing a tremendous return of king salmon to Pullen Creek this year.
Just to be clear, this is a broodstock run of king salmon. Eggs from returning females are harvested each year and reared in pens in Pullen Creek. They are released into the wild and returned to freshwater in usually 3 years. But there have not been enough fish to reach broodstock targets in recent years. In the last 8 years, the return of king salmon to Pullen Creek has averaged 137 fish through early August. This year, there are many more than that.
Well, through August 2nd, we have 448 kings counted at the weir, and that's about four times the average through that date.
Elliott says there are a few things that could be contributing to the large run this year. For one, these fish may have stayed an extra year at sea. Also, stricter management of the local drift gillnet fishery may have helped this stock, he says. There was little commercial effort on the east side of Lynn Canal this summer, the area where the Pullen Creek Kings like to move north into Tyatt Inlet. Still, it's a remarkable run, Elliott says.
It's surprising to me, because typically hatchery-produced king salmon do not survive as well as their wild stock counterparts. And so while our wild fish are declining in the Chilkat drainage, this return is pretty phenomenal. I think when we run the data, we're going to find out that survival is higher for these hatchery-produced fish than average.
With more than enough females to get the target broodstock, it might seem logical to collect more than the 300,000 eggs from 50 females needed for the goal. But Elliott says it's not that simple. The permitting on hatchery-raised fish is strict and only allows for the targeted number. Reporting from Haines, I'm Marga Friedenauer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Lisa Fu in Juneau, and Margaret Friedenauer in Haines. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by The Salmon Project. In Alaska, salmon are food, annual traditions, and a source of jobs, businesses, and community. Information on caring for salmon habitat or your weekend catch, plus salmon love stories at salmonlove.com. How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety. Where can you see more than 1,000 entertainers, from Alaska Native dancers to pirates? The Alaska State Fair. This year, everyone attending the fair can enjoy exhibits like the Cavallo Equestrian Arts, the Keith King BMX Stunt Show, Brad's World Reptiles, and with wonderful things from King Tut's tomb. Learn more at thealaskastatefair.org. Music, exhibits, and fun. It's what the Alaska State Fair is all about. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.